As the first speaker pointed out, the subject of our lecture today is Do Myths Have Meaning? The writer of world mythology, Robert Walters, when he once visited a library and he took his son with him, and as usual he pulled out a book and gave it to him to read. So the son said, "I know, Dad, what it is. It's going to begin with once upon a time, because all these books, they begin like that, once upon a time. I know sometimes I feel that these things couldn't have happened. But one thing I can tell you, they're so interesting and enchanting that I love reading these stories." The author says that we all love, no matter how grown up we are, these stories which begin with once upon a time. And they begin with once upon a time because these are the things which have happened long, long time ago. And the author points out that the story, in fact, the Greek word for it is mythos. And from that, the word myth is derived. So, mythos really means a story or a tale. But it is not an ordinary story. When you talk about mythos or myth, it is a fabulous statement or a fabulous story containing some important truth. And over a period of time, unfortunately, this was taken to be a fabulous, fantastic story, which is only a product of erratic fancy, incredible story, and therefore, slowly and gradually, these stories which contain truth of enormous importance came to be equated with falsehood. As against logos or truth. So there is mythos, which is falsehood, and there is logos, which is word of truth. But I think it is HPB who says in one place that in every mythos there is logos. In every mythos, there is a word of truth which is hidden, which you have to distill out from that particular myth. But luckily, not all authors are of that same opinion, that these are simply incredible and fantastic stories. Look at the approach of Joseph Campbell, who is supposed to be quite an authority on mythologies, who has studied world mythologies and compared them really. So he points out that in the very first quotation, the retelling of age-old tales for the sheer delight of their once upon a time is an art little practiced in our day. And yet, when the colorful sample of the art is brought to us, their fascination is of ways of life fundamentally different from our own, which yet speak somehow to some part of us which perhaps we have not been paying attention. And what is that part? The part of fantasy and dream, which may lead to vision and from vision onto a revelation of some kind, if not about the universe, then at least about ourselves. So these are supposed to be a very different kind of stories, which not only make an intellectual appeal, but if you are a sincere reader, it will call forth a lot of imagination. Something which we are not exercising during our usual reading, except of course we can say during science fiction, fiction reading, again that imagination sometimes comes into play. And that can lead you, if you dwell upon them, to such truths, if not about universe, about yourselves, as we shall see. Let us also read what HPB has to say, and this, by the way, is a quotation she gives from a scholar on Greek and Latin, that is Gerard Massey. And she has quoted him saying that for 30 years past, Professor Max Müller has been teaching that mythology is a disease of language, and that the ancient symbolism was a result of something like a primitive aberration, but they, Professor Müller, Cox, etc., have misrepresented it. Primitive or archaic man as having been idiotically misled from the first by an active but untutored imagination into believing all sorts of fallacies. My reply is, this is what Gerard Massey says, the origin and meaning of mythology have been missed altogether by these authors. Mythology was a primitive mode of thinking, the early thought. It was founded on natural facts and is still verifiable in phenomena. There is nothing irrational in it when considered in the light of evolution and when its mode of expression by sign language is thoroughly understood. Mythology is a repository of man's most ancient science. When truly interpreted once more, it is destined to be the death of false theologies. There is history in most of the allegories and myths of India, and events, real, actual events are concealed under them. So two things. One, that you have to read when you read mythologies, you won't get anything unless you understand the allegories and the symbols and the sign language in which they are written. And secondly, as we are so lucky that as HPB has pointed out, you will be able to find underneath them real, actual, historical facts which are enshrined in the mythical forms. For instance, she says that when the Egyptians said that, or they represented the moon goddess or moon by cat, are they trying really to puzzle us, or are they trying to say that moon is cat? She says no. Actually, just like cat is able to see in the dark, her eyes become luminous in the dark, so also moon is luminous in the night with the borrowed light of the sun, and in a way it is as it were a seer in the night. Comparing these two observations, they have represented several moon goddesses and moon gods by, say, showing the body of a man but the head of a cat. Now, this is a symbology. You have to interpret and understand it. Second part is about historical fact. We will all remember that very recently there was a controversy going on about Setu Samudram canal project. There is a Ram Setu, you see, which is supposed to connect India with Ceylon. And the controversy was going on because they are trying to, otherwise the boats which have to go from east to the west coast of India or west to the east coast of India, they have to go around Ceylon, and that's a long distance. So they feel that if you really break this Setu, which is called Ram Setu or Adam's Bridge, if you make a canal, it will have to traverse a shorter distance. Now, this is opposed by two sets of people. Environmentalists say that if you do that breaking of the bridge, there will be a greater risk of tsunamis. But the much greater opposition comes from people who are devotees of Ram. Because it is believed that, well, this Ram Setu was built by Rama, and we know the story in Ramayana, that when they were trying to go to Lanka, this was built by Rama with the help of Hanuman and his Vanar Sena. This Setu was built. So they feel that how can we do such a sacrilegious thing of breaking this thing. Now, the question which is arising and which was discussed in the newspapers for a long time is that the scholars are asking the question that did Ram really exist as a historical personage? To this, some people or some scholars say that, well, you can establish that yes, Ram existed, provided you find some concrete evidence in terms of monuments, inscriptions, certain points with effigy of Ram. Certain scholars are very wisely remarking that just because these sculptures and concrete evidence don't survive, it doesn't mean that these things did not happen. Rama exists in the collective consciousness of humanity. Now, this is one different approach. It need not be existing as a concrete evidence. And yet, luckily, we have a very definite statement coming from HPB, who says that Rama existed as a historical personage. And the city that he built exists, not right now as on the map of India, but as she says, it is lying beneath layers and layers of ruins of other cities, which are also of prehistoric nature. This is a fact, actually, that when the excavations take place, they find that they don't just excavate and find one city, but just like you have in the building, first, second, third, fourth floor, so also sometimes they have found 8 to 9 cities buried one under the other. And so similarly, she is pointing out that such a city built by Rama is existing. Not only that, there are certain points with the effigy of Rama that could be found. And more than that, she is pointing out to a work called Vamshavali. And this Vamshavali is supposed to be a genealogy of solar and lunar dynasties. Rama belonged to the solar dynasty. And she also says that this is lying in the royal library of Maharaja of Udaipur. And from this, certain Puranas have made their own genealogy, dynasties and divine genealogies and all have been constructed. But this is a definite work which is existing, where the mention of Rama and his kingdom and other things would be there. But we are also told that Rama existed, and various places in the secret doctrine we are told, and the students of theosophy will recognize, that there was a fourth race of Atlanteans, and that fourth race of Atlanteans and Ravana. Ravana and his Rakshasas are supposed to be representative of fourth or Atlantean race, whereas we are in the fifth or Aryan race. And Rama is supposed to be the first divine ruler of our fifth or Aryan race. And so the war between Rama and Ravana is the war between that degraded, degenerated Atlantean race and the Aryan adepts of the fifth race. Now, this is therefore some hint as to how history could be concealed under. So, entire mythology of Ramayana is built on actual historical fact. If we now turn and go a little bit into the very knowledge which is existing in the Aryan literature, we are told that Aryan knowledge can be divided into three parts. We are all aware that there is Shruti or revelation, which consists of Vedas. There is Smriti, where Manusmriti comes there, that is laws and tradition. But the third portion of this knowledge is Itihasa Purana. Itihasa is history, Puranas, and there are 18 Puranas, though we may not understand much of it now. But the third section of Itihasa Purana, that is history and Puranas together, is what constitutes our mythologies. And you will find, as we have already seen, the Itihasa portion is Ramayana and Mahabharata. The two great mystical epics are really forming the Itihasa or history. The Puranas are the 18 Puranas, and HPP has a lot to say in the secret doctrine. But one thing she points out, that don't think that these Puranas, which to you seem like abracadabra and a nonsense, is not that kind. Actually, if you really filter them off their fairy tale like stories, you will find that what the Puranas contain is really metaphysical and philosophical description of the dawn of creation. You will find, if you take care, that all the branches of modern science, zoology, physiology, botany, physics, chemistry, name it, and it would be reflected in the Puranas. Because she says that these old Aryans, who were the great metaphysicians and philosophers, they were not fools to waste their time in writing down these fairy tale nonsense. Nor were the initiated Brahmins, who are supposed to hold the key to the Puranas, also fools to study them and then also guard and preserve them. So there is something in that. She points out as one example that the Puranas mention seven rishis, seven manus, seven sages. What are these? They have several wives. They have a numerous progeny. What is all this? And HPB says that this is actually an account of the evolution in the animal kingdom from one species to another. One instance is given of Kashyapa. We have all heard Kashyapa is supposed to be the one rishi who had 12 wives, and he had a very great progeny. And progeny was what? The rishi had progeny of reptiles, nagas, birds, cows, buffaloes. He was father of all these. Now what does this mean? And she says this is actually a veiled record of the order of evolution. And this is something very important, because just recently, again, maybe 2 years back, some fossils were found in the Mongolia, in a fossil bed of Mongolia. And what they found was a very large leg with very large feathers of a dinosaur. And they named it Pedopena something. Now, Pedopena means a feathered foot. And the scientists were wondering that could this be the evidence, or can we find out from here the origin of birds and so on? What came first? What is the order of evolution? They were really wondering. And when you turn to secret doctrine, HPB does point out that Garuda is again supposed to be the progeny of Kashyap. Garuda himself, who is supposed to be the king of feathered tribe, you see, is the king bird as it were, supposed to have been earlier a serpent himself. And then now, having become Garuda, he is shown to be eating serpents. Now what does it all mean? She says that it simply means that one species gives way to another more perfect species. And here we are able to see the order of evolution, that it is from the reptiles that the birds have come. Because you have heard about flying lizards, flying dragons, flying serpents. So slowly and gradually there was a transformation, and the reptiles gives place to the birds. Now this veiled account is there very much in the Puranas, but one has to be able to read it. Now, coming back then to the mythologies part of it, so the Puranas is a great repository of the mythologies which needs to be filtered and understood. Now, every world mythology, if you take, it would have mythology of creation, it would have mythology of humanity, it would have mythology of cosmic disasters, and so on. Myth of creation. HPP gives its interpretation in Transactions of Blavatsky Lodge, where there is a Hindu myth of creation. Again, a very fantastic story, and which till we came to Theosophy, we didn't understand that it is talking about creation. We are told about how Devas and Daityas are supposed to have gathered on Mount Meru, and they decided to churn the ocean. And for the churning of the ocean, they used Mount Mandara, and the rope for churning was snake Vasuki. Everything would have its significance, but not much is given. Now, after the churning of the ocean, 14 very wonderful things came out as a result of churning. And of course, we are told what came out was sun, moon, goddess Lakshmi came out, Amrit, then poison, cow Surabhi, and so on. There are 14 wonderful things. But what is this churning of the ocean? And HPB says that because, like the Christians, Hindus never believed that world was created. So they said that the world is, as it were, coming out from the chaos. Now what is this chaos? Chaos is the primordial matter. It is homogeneous matter, which in Sanskrit is called Mula Prakriti. Undifferentiated, homogeneous, primordial matter. And the churning of the ocean actually represents differentiation of these matters at various levels. When it gets differentiated, what happens when you churn? You have buttermilk left behind, but on top you have butter which floats on it. And exactly like that, we are told in the secret doctrine, exactly like that, after differentiation of that homogeneous matter, what is seen is clusters and lumps of matter, which is the cosmic matter from which our Milky Way is formed. And that matter which goes in formation of Milky Way undergoes further differentiation and gives rise to various planets, stars, and then finally our universe and worlds and so on. So this is ingenious way of showing how the formation of the world or creation of the universe takes place. As for the other parts about the 14 wonderful things and all, HPB doesn't give any explanation. She says that, well, it is the real meaning of these things is taught only at the time of fourth initiation. So that means when you have gone very far ahead in your spiritual development, you are told about the real meaning of these things. But we are told there, at the end of the myth, that Amrit came out. And Devas and Danavas were fighting for it. And very cunningly, it seems, Vishnu gave this Amrit to Devas. They drank it and became immortal. So there was war in heaven. This is another important thing. This is one allegory which has several meanings, and at several places in the Puranas you find reference to war in heaven. Now, this war in heaven, at a very simple level, it is the war between Devas and Danavas. And in man, as it is said, if you look within, and we are going to see it in the last quotation, if you interiorize this symbology, you will find all these things happening within you. So, there are Devas and Danavas in man. There is a Daivi, or rather divine nature, and there is the demonic or animal nature. And one who is trying to live the life and become an adept, he will face this war between his lower and a higher nature, till finally the divine nature, as it were, becomes supreme or acquires supremacy. There is a war in heaven which, as we said, one of the meanings is the war between the fourth race Atlanteans and the fifth race Aryan adepts. Another war in heaven was, as it were, enacted when it is said that Soma, moon, is supposed to have eloped with Tara. Now, Soma, moon, eloping with Tara. Tara is supposed to be wife of Jupiter. What is all this things about? And here again HPB points out that Jupiter represents ritualistic, dogmatic, exoteric form of religious worship. Tara is his wife. And therefore, it is a spiritual aspirant who is joined to, or rather taking interest in, this exoteric dead letter form of worship. Soma or moon, we will go into only one aspect, time will not permit. But Soma or moon is supposed to be presiding over a spiritual and a mystical element in man and universe. And therefore, he is interested in seeing that a human man undergoes and gets a second or spiritual birth. And that is why this whole thing, that Tara on one hand is wedded to Jupiter, that is ritualistic form of worship, but on the other hand, she elopes with moon, that shows spiritual aspiration. All of us have these two natures. One nature is quite grounded in the traditions and customs and maybe exoteric religion. Another aspect is aspiring towards something spiritual. And when that spiritual aspiration is united with Soma or moon, it is called being initiated into occult mysteries. And as a result of being initiated into occult mysteries, their son is called Buddha, Mercury, or Hermes, that is spiritual wisdom or esoteric knowledge. So the result of that aspiration and being initiated as a result is esoteric wisdom or spiritual knowledge. And that is represented by Buddha, Mercury. In India, it is represented as Ganesha, the Lord of Wisdom. It is also represented as Harmanubis, Anubis. In every mythology, you will have a god who is having some form, shape, name, but who represents this sort of a esoteric wisdom. Now, what are these gods? If you take very closer look, you find that all of them, they have a body of man and the head of the animal. And this is also very significant. It is a very significant part of mythology where the gods are being discussed. And one meaning, a very simple meaning given in notes on the Bhagavad Gita by Mr. Jad is that it shows that a spiritual aspirant must have both. He must have the knowledge and wisdom which arises from the human nature or perfected human man, but it must also have the strength which comes from the brute or animal, spiritual energy. Because if you have the strength, but if you don't have the knowledge, it can be misused. If you have the knowledge, but if you don't have the strength, you can't really put it into action. But the other meaning is something, again, which is something which is hiding actual historical fact. And what is that? We are told that this representation of Ganesha as having a dual aspect of man and the head of animal, or of Harmanubis, who has the face of a dog and the body of human, it is really reminding us of the fact of third race. That in the third race, humanity at one point in time was senseless. In the sense, it was mindless. Man was man only in the body, but it was an animal man. The mind was not lighted up. And that's why it is represented as having the head of a man. I mean, head of an animal. It is also reminding us of the fact that there was at that point, the mindless man committed the sin of uniting with huge she animals at that time. So it was an unnatural union between man and animals. And the progeny is what we see today as anthropoid apes. So, of course, scientists are wondering, how come apes are so much closer to humanity? So have man descended from apes? Does man and apes have common ancestors? But the actual fact is lying in this fact, that there was the unnatural union between human beings and these animals in the far, far back past. And that progeny is anthropoid apes, and that fact is, as it were, immortalized in these gods who are represented with the body of a human being and the head of the animal. Now, this is also very interesting, that there is a certain point in time when man got the light of mind. And students of Theosophy are very much familiar with what it is. That it is after getting the light of mind from certain divine beings, which we call as Agnishvata Pitris, solar deities, that man became a thinking, choosing, self-conscious being. And this fact of lighting up of the manas is put in the mythical form in the myth of Prometheus. We are told that Prometheus actually represents this host of jnanis or host of solar angels who gave man the light of mind. So that mind became activated, so that man became a thinking and choosing being. Now this Prometheus, it is therefore in the mythology said, he brought or stole fire from heaven and he brought it to earth. And for this, Zeus, who is supposed to be a progenitor of only physical man, equivalent to our Prajapatis, who are supposed to be only concerned with the physical man, Zeus is supposed to punish Prometheus for giving man this fire or the light of mind. He is tied to a rock. And what is the torture? A vulture is sent every day to peck at his liver. And it is said that when the liver is eaten completely by the vulture, new liver will spring. Again the torture will begin and so on. What does it all signify? It means that this mind, which functions through the body, it becomes dual when it is functioning through the body of man. And what is that duality? A large portion of the mind gets entangled in our personal passions, desires, only worldly affairs and personal concerns. That portion of the mind is lost. It is not united with the divine nature. And therefore, the vultures actually represent our karmic nature, in which the portion of the mind, as it were, is getting eaten away by the lower propensities. And it is lost. But again, at every new incarnation, a new ray of mind is launched. Now, this is what is meant by new liver springing up every time, and once again the torture begins. So the whole fact about the human mind, prostitution of the power of thinking, feeling, and therefore wasting the powers of mind, it's all allegorized in the myth of Prometheus. Now Prometheus, as HBB shows, the very word comes from the Sanskrit Pramantha, and she says that Pramantha in turn is derived from the Sanskrit Manthami, meaning stirring, and she says that therefore Prometheus represents Pavamana fire. We won't go into it, it is a very abstruse subject. It is a fire by friction, fire produced by friction, and that is in the Vedic sutras it is pointed out that when you, if you take a stick and if you rapidly stir in a socket, first there is heat and then there is sparks and fire produced. If two branches also brush against each other, you have a fire, sparks, and then fire is produced. So it is a fire by friction, but it's an important fire, this Pavamana fire, and the stick is called Pramantha and that socket is called Arani. So there is Pramantha and Arani, and that is in a way also representing something similar to what we have Lingam and Yoni, the female and the male generative principles in nature. Now this, what we call as the fire by friction, which was given by Prometheus, it is supposed to bring about a link or cement Atma Buddhi with mind. Now till then it is said that what was the position like? The divine nature of man was working on its own plane. The animal nature was working on its own plane. There was no link between them. But when Prometheus brought this light, not only did the mind get united with Atma Buddhi, but through mind, the divine nature of man also could contact and be cemented with the personality of man. So this is a very important fact. Now we said that the allegory or the Promethean myth, myth of Prometheus goes on to tell us that it was Heraclitus, Heracles or Hercules, who is supposed to have released Prometheus from this torture which was put upon him by Zeus. Now what is this Hercules? We know that there are 12 adventures of Hercules, and it only shows that this mind, which has a tendency to get wrapped up in passions and desires and worldly concerns, it can extricate itself from the lower karmic nature, and then it can become an organ of free will and guide of highest mental faculties. It can unite itself with divine nature, and once the mind unites itself with divine nature, you will be in possession of great powers and shaktis. But this whole process of purifying the mind, extricating it from the lower nature and uniting it with the higher nature, it's a process. In fact, we can say it's a whole battlefield of spiritual life. And that is why the struggles, the trials, the temptations one has to pass through, all this is depicted through the 12 labors, they are called, of Hercules. And finally Hercules, he succeeds in freeing, as it were, this Prometheus, who is bound by the passions and desires, that aspect of the mind. One of the things is taming of the lineal lion. Time will not permit, so let us go ahead. The other, this thing is about his meeting with a serpent with 9 heads. And it is told in that allegory that as he would cut one head of the serpent, 2 heads would arise in its place. And now he takes help of his nephew, who has a burning torch. So immediately as he cuts the head, this nephew cauterizes that portion of the neck so that new head will not arise. And thus he is able to cut all the heads one by one, and finally he is able to kill that 9-headed serpent. What does it mean? Of course, we talk about Hydra-headed ambition, we talk of Hydra-headed desire. Gita talks about 100 cords of desire. Ravana is supposed to have 10 heads. This is talking about myriad faces of our lower personal nature. It also talks about various aspects, from the very gross to the very subtle aspect in which every vice you may have to kill. But it also points out something very important, that as we are told in the Voice of the Silence, that kill out desire, but if thou killest, take heed that lest from the dead it should again arise. If you fill it out on a surface level, you know, you say that no, with a great effort of will, you push down the desire. You have suppressed your desire. You may repress your desire. But as soon as the conducive circumstances come, it comes again. So you have not understood, you have not tackled it, you have not eradicated it. So long as it is not removed from the roots, like that head of the serpent, it can come again. So this is probably, there would be many meanings to it, but one of the meanings would be that. And then in one of the adventures, it is said that he goes into the Patala, Hades, and some adventure over there is there. We will speak about that a little later. But after this, let us turn to another very important mythology. And we are able to take this up because HPP, fortunately, has given us some key to understand. And that is called the myth of Odysseus. There are wanderings of Odysseus or Ulysses. And you know how Mr. Judd says that once it was reading interpretation of the wanderings of Ulysses which put me into elevated state of consciousness. Now, what is this myth about Ulysses? It is said that he was a king of Ithaca and he sets out on a war, which is a Trojan war. And after fighting that war, he is coming back home. He is homeward bound. And in this, along with his army, he is crossing the ocean and coming. There is a very wonderful interpretation given in volume 24 of the Theosophical Movement by, I think, Thomas Taylor or Robert Taylor. But it's a very wonderful interpretation, besides what is given by HPB in The Secret Doctrine. Now, we are told that one thing is, that are we not all? This is actually depicting the journey of the soul. We are all supposed to be, as HPB says, humanity is an emanation from divinity on its return path. He is going home, back to his spiritual home. And he is crossing ocean. Often we speak about going across the Bhavasagara, crossing across the ocean of samsara. And what is it? In the beginning it is said that the fleet of ships in the beginning was completely guarded by the ocean god. And that is Neptune. And that Neptune not only presides over the ocean, but it is also depicting presiding over the sense life. So you are completely guided by your sense life. Temptations here, temptations there, you are drawn here and there. Therefore, it is called wanderings of Ulysses. You are a wanderer first. You have not the definite idea where to go. And as a great storm or stormy wind takes his ship, fleet of ships in a certain direction. And he is completely guided, therefore, by this ocean god and wanders. Later on, when you take evolution in your own hand, you become a pilgrim soul. Till then, you are a wanderer. Now, the very first adventure is again very suggestive, and as it happens in the case of every one of us, he is supposed to have met the lotus eaters, and we are told that he starts enjoying life with these lotus eaters and forgets his mission. Often it happens for the beginners that you are waylaid in some by-lane. You think you are following spirituality, but you are not. Or you are tempted by some earthly temptation, and therefore you forget your spiritual goal, and you are on a totally different path. The second adventure is when the goddess on some island gives them some drink, and they are drunk. Some of them turn into swine, but it is said that he heeds the voice of Hermes, and that Hermes, as we said, represents your buddhi or spiritual discrimination, voice of conscience, and therefore he does not drink. There is this going into Hades or Patala even for Odysseus. What does it represent? It means that at a certain stage in the life of the candidate, they are made to go into underground crypts and caves. They are made to face their own lower consciousness with all its baseness, purify it and come out triumphant. This is the mystery of initiation, in which you are made to go and face the dark side of your nature. And that is like going into Hades or Patala. The very last adventure is talking about his meeting a one-eyed giant, Polyhemus. And he is supposed to take a very burning torch and put out, or rather scorch out, that particular one eye which was there. And HPB tells us that what is all this? Actually, it is a historical meaning which is behind it, that there were three cyclopes. One was Polyhemus, and the other two cyclopes, we are not given the name here. These three are supposed to represent a still earlier race of humanity, which are called the Lemurians. And the last three sub-races of the Lemurian race, they were all having what is called a spiritual intuition, a spiritual eye, which is called the eye of Shiva, the third eye, call what you will. And there was only that single eye, even physically. The other two eyes were hardly developed. And they developed only in the fourth race. Whereas Ulysses himself is supposed to be the hero of the fourth race. So this, in a way, is showing Ulysses burning out. That one eye of the Polyhemus is showing how gradually when man or the humanity of the third and the fourth race became more and more materialized, they started misusing the spiritual powers they had. What happened was that there was atrophy of the spiritual powers and spiritual eye. And that is shown allegorically by Ulysses putting out that one eye of the Polyhemus. And this description is there in that long, this thing which says, the one-eyed cyclopes, the fabled giants, three in number according to Hesiod, were the last three sub-races of the Lemurians, and the one eye referring to wisdom eye. For the two front eyes were fully developed as the physical organs only in the beginning of the fourth race. The allegory of Ulysses, whose companions were devoured while the king of Ithaca was saved, by putting out with the firebrand the eye of Polyhemus the cyclope, is based upon the psychophysiological atrophy of the third eye. Ulysses belongs to the cycle of heroes of the fourth race. His adventures with the latter, that is the Cyclopes, is an allegorical record of the gradual passage of the Cyclopean civilization of stone and colossal buildings to the more sensual and physical culture of Atlanteans, which finally caused the last of the third race to lose all their penetrating spiritual eye. So losing the spiritual power and intuitive power is what is described over here. Now, again, we won't be able to go into it, but it is debated whether really such a thing took place. HPP's time, for a long time people were saying that there is nothing like Troy. All of this is only imaginary tale which is built up. It is only allegorical. But finally, it is said that somebody called Professor Shilman, he is supposed to have found that there were nine cities. We were mentioning it earlier. There were nine cities found. There is an article in, I think, Hard Doctrine, Cities Upon Cities. So, nine cities were found, and scholars felt that it is the seventh layer which represents this Troy. So, it was established at that time that Troy actually existed. In fact, HPB says that Troy existed and that it did not exist somewhere around 1000 BC as it was felt, but 5000 to 6000 BC. It is as ancient as that. Also, we are pointed out that Iliad, which is written also by Homer, it's an account based on Ramayana. And Odyssey is also talking about something which have taken place. We won't go into the controversy which is going on, that very recently some archaeologists found on a Cephalonia island with a Paliki peninsula. That Paliki peninsula, which is now a peninsula, would have been an island. And that is where the king of Ithaca must have had his kingdom. It must have been an island first. Now it has become a peninsula. But we don't have definite any word from HPP regarding that. Now, HPP points out, however, the importance of Iliad and Odyssey when she says that if Gladstone had ever had a real inkling of the esoteric meaning of Iliad and Odyssey, he would have understood St. John's revelation and even the Pentateuch better than he does. For the way to Bible lies through Hermes, Bell and Homer, as the way to these is through the Hindu and Chaldean religious hymns. So understanding Homer will give you a little better understanding of the Bible, of the Pentateuch and so on. Now, one thing again is sure that these myths, they have a definite place and they are required, as we can find out, that they are holding important spiritual truths. Not only are they hiding histories, but as when we were studying Vernal Blooms, Mr. Jack says, no, that when a person who has crossed the grates of gold and he has glimpses of the spiritual realities when he comes back and when he starts talking, people don't understand him because these abstract things which he has experienced, how is he going to convey them? If he starts conveying them in our language, as we know, his language will not be sufficient. So, for this purpose, sometimes the language of symbols, the language of allegory, and the language of myth also is used sometimes. And that is why, as Professor C.S. Lewis rightly says, that all our real experiences, they are concrete experiences. Whereas mind and intellect is an abstraction. But the moment you try to apprehend these concrete realities with your intellect or mind, you feel that they are going out of your grip. They are going out of your hand. They slip away. He gives the example that you have a toothache and you feel that you will write a nice essay on what pain is about. But when the toothache stops, what do you know about pain? It is something like that. So it is so difficult to put it into language. And he says myth is a partial solution to this dilemma, that the concrete things are not able to be represented into the actual words or language of the humanity. He also points out that you can look upon a myth as a some sort of a mountain from which various streams arise. And all these streams, they meet in a valley. That is where we live, as it were. And when that truth, which is as myriad streams, it is coming out from that myth, they will come to the valley, it is like one flowing river. And a person who interprets that one truth which is in his hand, he will not get much unless he looks at it from various perspectives. Because as a myth, actually it has various facets. In the myth it is existing as various streams which has become one stream here. So you will have to look at it from various angles. And therefore, this is what we will not read that part. But that is why HPP says that to interpret every myth, you must have seven keys. The so-called myths, in order to be at least approximately dealt with in any degree of justice, have to be closely examined from all their aspects. In truth, every one of these seven keys has to be used in its right place. There are seven keys. Student doesn't remember the names of all of them, but anthropological key, astronomical key, psychological key, geometrical key, metaphysical key. There are so many keys which you have to turn if you want to get the complete meaning of them. For instance, there was a very lovely article in the February issue of the Theosophical Movement about philosophy of Ramayana. And there we are told that Ramayana, at least three keys are given. You look upon Ramayana and there is a psychological key. See, each character has its own peculiar psychology. You take Mantra, you take Kaikeyi, you take Rama, Dashrath, Sita. Each is a peculiar psychological character. Now you can look within and you may find that all of them really exist in you. So one psychological key can be applied to understand this human psychology. Another thing is, there is an ethnological or anthropological key. Because after all, what is that? Rama is supposed to be the first divine ruler of the fifth race. Something about that fifth race you come to know when you study that Ramayana. And there is a third, which is the student is not able to really understand why it's called astrological or astronomical key, which really is binding the heaven and earth. It shows the link between heaven and earth, because what are these? Many of these characters are incarnations. So those characters which otherwise reside on higher planes, heavenly planes as it were, they have come incarnated in bodies when mortals require them and enact the drama and maybe set an example, like Rama set an example of being Maryada Purushottam and so on. So in a way it will become astrological, astronomical key. I don't know why it is called that. But it is also a key in itself to understand through these the whole concept of how the divine beings sometimes they take actually human form and live among human beings. But it all depends. The answer to the question, do myths have meaning? Even at the end of the lecture, we can put this question and find out, do myths have meaning? And very rightly, as Professor Lewis says, it depends upon the reader. It depends upon the listener. You can read the myth superficially and you will put it aside as a nonsense. Like HPP says, that like a nonsensical farrago, people will throw away Puranas who don't understand. You can read it and probably you will get it as an exciting, enchanting story and you will be thrilled for that much time and get only the story aspect. But as he says, you have to be extra literary. You are not required only to be literary. You have to be extra literary. Not just submit your mind, but your imagination, your very intuition must come into play to get the meaning. And that can happen if even ordinarily. If we have been looking at the world around us, not with the superficial eye. A lovely incident comes to our mind. The Buddhist teacher Sangha Rakshita, when he was taking a walk with a Nepalese Buddhist friend, and they saw a lovely pine tree. And Sangha Rakshita remarked that, isn't this a lovely tree? And the Nepali friend said, yes, there is enough firewood in that tree to last entire winter. And Sangharakshita said he never saw the tree. He only saw the wood there. So, what comes to the student's mind is that the tree itself is a great symbology. And when these trees are used in the mythologies, what can you get out of that? If you have only looked upon the tree as something which gives you fruit or crops or that something which has only firewood, you are not going to be able to interpret that great symbology of, which is lying in that symbol of myths. Read Secret Doctrine and read Isis Unveiled, and you can really write one whole book on the mythology of tree. So much is given there. Now, so it depends upon the reader, and that is why with the last quotation, this is what we are told. You hold in your hands a book about myths, which is to say a book about metaphors, the tools of poets and artists. Read these pages as you would read a dream journal. For the task of the modern human being is to interiorize mythic symbology, to realize that all the gods and demons are within, to understand that heaven, hell and other such realms are not places somewhere out there to which you go when you die, but psychological states within us all. Accordingly, approach this book, this is what the author says, approach this book with an open mind, with the innocence of the child. Probably we have 2 minutes for asking questions. We are very sorry to have exceeded the time. They are all closely related, and as we did not read that, it is saying one of this thing. Similarly, fairy tales reveal one aspect of the human subconscious, the psychic nature of every man. It is not just talking about psychic nature in the sense of our emotional nature, but you know, psychic realm is the astral realm. And most of the fairy tales, if you read Arabian Nights, if you read any other like Cinderella, where always a fairy comes with a wand and some sort of a magical thing is done, that's all pertaining to the psychic realm. Something to do with the elementals, something to do with the lower gods and certain psychic powers. So fairy tales are accounts of these things.
How to explain this to the scientific mind?
It's very difficult. How to explain this to the scientific mind? And that is why even HPP has not, as it were, succeeded in, shall we say, converting people. We must all read that what is given in the Secret Doctrine about all the references on Puranas, where she finally leaves by making an appeal to the Brahmin students in India, and she says that you people who have a long line of degrees, Indian and what you got from abroad, I make an appeal to you that with open mind, approach the Puranas. And you will find, I can assure you, you will learn more from them than all that you learn from your universities and colleges. But she is telling them to have an open mind and approach. But she leaves it to them to do that. So also we can tell the scientists that have an open mind, but more importantly, also have intuitive mind. That is why our reading today was actually emphasizing the importance of intuition. It is not to be approached with the everyday mind or even intellectual mind, but intuitive.